Sarah Elizabeth Brown.
Hi.
This is Jay Michaels.
Hi, Jay.
I didn't expect you to call me. I was actually gearing up to call you.
Okay, well, if you need some more time, I just thought
nope.
I was after.
I am totally fine. I am totally fine. You just saved my dialing finger. And if I'm on the line, you're on the air. We are recording your interview. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Congratulations. Your show's going up at the Fresh Fruit Festival, which is one of the larger, more respected festivals in New York these days. So I'm thrilled for you.
I'm very excited.
And I was really happy to see what kind of show you're doing. I love anthologies. I love multiple stories and things like that. There are movies like Love Actually and a few others whose titles escape me. They're all one or two words that are absolutely brilliant. You're sort of doing the LGBTQ chorus line here, which is great. Tell us about the show. Tell us about everything to do with it.
Well, it's really a celebration of inclusion and acceptance, a celebration of voices. This is based on about 30 different interviews I did back in Santa Fe in 2000. I had a grant from the Santa Fe Community Foundation to do a story collecting project. I had just done another story collecting project around mental health issues, and that was very successful. And so the community commissioned me to do another one.
Now, are these scenes between people? Do they interact, or is it a group of monologues?
It's a group of monologues.
Excellent.
Although,
excellent.
Sort of like Eve Ensler's vagina monologues, they're composite pieces.
Right.
So they're sculpted, and there's some craft to them. They're not all just pure interviews.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. You've jumped on a trend train. The notion of the one-person show has become one of the hottest tickets in New York. So you're essentially handing us 8 one-person shows, which is absolutely
right.
Wonderful. Tell us more. Tell us about these people that we're going to meet that night. Your characters.
Well, yeah. There's Sadie, who's a Midwesterner who makes Jell-O salad and tells us about her affair with a Harley Davidson motorcyclist. And
okay, there's the Jell-O salad. Great. I saw it in the description. I was like, where the hell does that? Okay, now I got it. Good. Okay.
Well, it's sort of like I was interviewing this woman and she was very Midwestern and sort of down to earth and like, she's like, oh yeah. And then, you know, and then we started doing SM and, you know, like she just, her story just gets more and more out there, but in this kind of down to earth way, it's just a person. I mean, I feel like back then these stories were, kind of more risque or something. We're kind of immune to that now in some ways, but they're very real. And I think we don't always get an intimate look into the realness and it's not done in a shocking way. It's just done in a very wholesome, generous, authentic way. I think
that's great.
People just really were generous in sharing their stories. I mean, back then we were not having as much of the transgender conversation, and I talked to a lot of people who were transitioning,
mm-hmm.
you know, female to male, and more just the male to female were just people in my life that I knew. But I had talked to a number of female to male people who are transitioning, and that was not, there was not as much, we hadn't had the bathrooms issues and all that come into the news yet. The military stuff, it took a lot of courage, and I really loved hearing these stories. And all the people that I interviewed came to the show when we did it in 2000, it premiered in New Mexico.
Oh,
and
that's wonderful.
What was it like
for them to hear themselves up there as characters? Did you get any feedback from them? Were they shocked? Were they proud? What was it?
I think it was celebrated. There was one woman, an academic, who has a story of unrequited love and kind of, in her own words, describing herself as kind of the ugly duckling, but really loving this woman and her family that kind of was this New York kind of more elite life that she hadn't been exposed to. And I think she came like every night of the show. And even though her story is kind of painful, or maybe it was painful for her, she just became really good friends with the actress who played her. And she just, I think she got a lot of healing out of it, actually. I think she saw the humanity of what it is. I mean, I think it can feel very lonely to have unrequited love. These are all love stories, by the way. That was the question I asked people, was about their key love stories. So I think her story was very painful for her. I think she got a lot of healing. And I think, you know, that sense of the universalness, when you see that other people really relate to your story. And she had some distance because it was an actress doing it, and she's just sitting in the dark, and, you know, other people can relate to her story. And I really got a sense that she felt less alone and humanized by the experience.
You sort of answered my next question. I was going to say, what was the outcome? Was it cathartic? Did it open conversations? It sounds like it did. It sounded like it just opened the floodgates for a lot of people.
I think it was, they're very authentic stories. What's nice about it, them being interviews instead of just something that I invented, is that there's something about the voices that I could never invent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They really speak in their own language and their own truth. And I think there was a lot of humor in it. I remember a lot of laughter in the audience. I mean, we didn't have talkbacks and that kind of thing, but it was a Pride time. We had very full houses. It was at Pride, and it was just lovely.
Do you find the laughter was the laughter of truth? Like, so many, did you see lots of nodding heads or side glances, like, oh, this happened to me, or I'm so happy I'm not alone, or things like that? Do you think it was cathartic for your audience as well?
I do think so. I think these maybe stories were a little bit less known back then, or it felt like truth coming forward.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And a lot of it was my friends who I interviewed, so.
Oh, even better. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Did you find out things about your friends that you walk away from an interview going, oh my God, did that really happen to them? Did you get shocked by things that you heard?
I got enlightened by things. I think definitely when you interview people and you sit down, even if you know them and you're like, okay, tell me your key love story, it's different from just a regular conversation. So I had no idea. I definitely had no idea. And I think there's a sacredness about storytelling. I do it in my work too, in mental health. I work in a school in Harlem where part of that, we have it's like a 5-month training cycle, and there's a week where I do story sharing with them, and they tell mm-hmm. their key stories, and they've known each other. Here they've known each other for 3 months or so, and then they share their story, and they suddenly see each other completely differently. So I think that there's something, there's a gift in someone sharing their story or sharing what's the most important thing that's happened to them, that we as a culture are craving that kind of authenticity. It's different from someone just coming up to you and just bombarding you with, like, oh, let me just tell you, you know, like over talking you or something. There's something deeper and sacred and a gift about someone sharing some of their most intimate experiences with you. And I think that's what I'm hoping for the audience, to have that sense of authenticity. I feel like we are craving that all the time. We're always on social media looking for things now, and you can tell, you know, when somebody posts something really real and you're like, oh, that's what I was looking for, I didn't even know it. I think, yeah, we're hungry for that heart center.
That's great. I agree with you. An old buddy of mine from 100 years ago, I follow him on Facebook. I haven't seen him in decades. And he talked about some lonely time he had on Thanksgiving, and I was blown away. I was like, I would never imagine that about mm-hmm. him. And it made me look at him in a completely different light. It opened my heart even more toward him. So that brings up an interesting question. We always talk badly about social media. We're at that point now where we think social media is a work of the devil. I don't, but okay. Now, Do you think social media, do you think a happy ending, if you will, with social media is that it's created a sense of storytelling in us? We're so used to typing our inner feelings that to speak them is actually coming back into vogue, if you will, because that was the ancient form. You know, we didn't have history books or social media. We all, you know, you had the shaman who told the great stories of the great leaders. Do you think it's coming back that people are almost wanting to converse now? Do you think we're going to have the human touch once again because of things like this?
Well, two things come to mind. One thing is I do think, you know, social media can be used for good or evil. Like it can be soul numbing, but there can be these moments of authenticity that come through that really
soul numbing. That's great. That's well, great.
You know, it can be this real shutdown and sort of like glazing over and wait, oh, where did those hours go that I was just, you know, surfing this or that. But then you hit this gem and you're like, oh, that's what there was some truth I was looking for and finding. But I do think that especially young people are hungry for real life experiences. It's becoming kind of more rare to have a real interface with human beings.
That is true.
So in that sense, I do think, I don't know, you're the trendsetter. You're in charge more of knowing of the trends than I, you being doing what you're doing on social media. But I would hope so. I work with people, you know, tend to be younger than me who are hungry and doing a lot of this kind of thing. And they, I see that they're hungry for real experiences and the live theater experience is definitely, an interface with real people. There's a beautiful actors involved in this piece who are, they're yummy. I mean, actually, the truth is I haven't met them, but I saw all their headshots and they all just look so, you can see in their headshots, they just look yummy and, and real and delicious. They have a presence. And so I know I'm hungry to like be in a room with them and they have a uniqueness that comes off them. And this is really a piece about diversity and different kinds of people and, you know, inclusion and sharing, So I'm definitely looking forward to that live experience.
You hit two very important points really astutely. In terms of headshots, I've noticed this also. I'm a child of the 80s. I was doing all this good stuff in the 80s. And there, everybody looked the same. Oh, my gosh, you airbrushed out anything. You photoshopped anything. My gosh, I look at my headshot and I thought, I didn't look that pretty back then. but nowadays, people's headshots are so much more honest. They're so much more real. If you're looking at a headshot and that's who's walking in the room, as a casting person, I can tell you the people that walked in the room, I'm like, this is not you in this picture. And now we're getting that. Now people are just, they're being very honest, which is wonderful. You said something quite brilliant, which is, and you talk about trend. This is the trend. The millennial generation does not buy things, they buy experiences. So to be touched by someone else's life is exactly what we're looking for these days. So you've hit it on the head.
Mm.
Do you think, now you did this out in Santa Fe, and were you living there at the time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I lived for 10 years in Santa Fe.
Okay. How do you think these stories are translating into our hard-bitten, you know, rough and tumble New York audience? Do you think the audience is going to listen to it and go, yeah, I've been there? Or do you think they're still going to feel it?
And also, we're going to feel it.
We're also talking a long enough time that you're talking about things that have conquered, that have succeeded. How do you think your New York audience is going to be sitting there?
Well, that is a great question. we shall see how it has held up. We shall see. But I still think that there's still like a truth in the pieces. I had some people read it recently who were like, yeah, we weren't ready to hear this 20 years ago. Like, okay. we're just finally ready to hear this now. So even though you might hear about transgender issues or blah, 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 do you really, how have you really had the chance to like sit down and hear someone share what their experience is really like. Or, yeah, okay, everybody is going to Pride now. I mean, like, hey, we won the game. We invited everyone to the party and everybody's there now. So we don't have this like secret world quite as much anymore. Like that's when I was coming up, it was more like we had like our own secret culture or something. And we were trying to invent relationships outside of the dominant culture. And then we just got into the marriage equality thing. And then we decided, no, we're going to join the mainstream. We're going to go for this inclusion thing. And I feel like we gave up some of our sort of specialness and our weirdness and stuff.
The cutting edge. Yeah.
Right, in order to fit in. But I think ultimately that was a good move. And so I think everybody is coming to the party, literally. Everybody's coming to Pride. So I think overall there's more acceptance and everybody's kind of joining in together. But I'm not sure that we've heard the stories or we've listened to people's hearts this intimately. So I think that's still a gift. That's still a window at any time into somebody's truth. And I think it will be interesting for me to see how things have changed and what feels old and what feels new. I mean, it definitely becomes an unintentional snapshot into where we were 20 years ago, you know?
I get the sense that when I watch something like Angels in America or The Boys in the Band, I feel in the audience a certain vibe how can I put this? There's a catharsis knowing that certain things have been conquered, mm-hmm. and there's this empathy saying, "Oh, I'm sorry you went through it, but thank you because look at the future. Thanks to you." I hear this when people talk about my mother's a Holocaust survivor, so mm-hmm. when her family would speak of that, even now, how many decades later, it still has again that same sort of feel. Do you think that your play has the chance to be that kind of chronicle that in 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, people are going to listen to this and go, yeah, remember that? Wow. And suddenly it becomes this catharsis for them?
Maybe so. I mean, I could see that potentially happening. I mean, there's, even though these are eight different pieces, there are like three stories that are connected. And that were my friends who were having a commitment ceremony. And there was our gay friend who was going to like impregnate one of them and have a baby. And so there's like their three stories. And so there is a sense of like, that was before we were even talking about marriage equality.
Right, right.
You know, and them having, you know, the courage to kind of have a real ceremony and what their family thought of it. And of course now there's all kinds of ways of doing babies. Not that I'm real up on that, but it's
yeah, Grubhub does it. It's great. Yeah. You can order a baby.
But I mean, you know, if it's more of a conversation to do it in a non-traditional way.
Right.
Or something
right.
Like that. But I also think that like the theme of love, is timeless. So, you know, even if they were whatever heterosexual love stories, I would still be interested in them. You know, I'm interested in love stories. I think my genre in theater and in script writing is romantic comedy. Mm. And some people are like, oh, I hate those. They're just formulaic or whatever. Why do people go to them? Well, I think people go to them because, for one thing, you know, it's going to be a safe movie. Like you're not going to see a lot of gratuitous violence or,
right.
you know, something like
right.
that. You know, you're going to talk about relationships and you know, you're going to have your faith in love be renewed, you know, I mean, people finding their way to connection. I'm always interested in that. I'm always interested in how people find a way to each other. So for me, even if these were not, I mean, they have a political component because they're from the queer community and these are sort of forbidden love stories in a way. But to me, I'm always going to be interested in love, no matter what form it takes, you know.
So these are our good old love stories. Forget about who the people are because it's a new world, so it's new people to look at. But you're going to see this, you know, with a couple of tissues because you may end up crying. And it's just a beautiful love story that you're handing us. It's just
it's a beautiful eight group love of love stories.
Eight beautiful love stories. Wow. Well, that's not too bad for one evening.
Yeah, I think it's a little gem in a way. I mean, you know, as I reread it in the recent years, I just think, wow, there's something really precious about it. You know, like it, yes, I shaped it and stuff like that, but it was a communal effort. It seems bigger than me, you know, and, it's a beautiful little piece with a lot of different people's hearts held into it.
I think Shakespeare had the right idea. He realized that the playwright is the historian. Today, the comedian is the newscaster. So Shakespeare is completely correct that the playwright is the historian. I saw a documentary on Richard III and found that he was just a paranoid king with scoliosis. But, you know, he's this monster in Shakespeare. So you are essentially giving us the future. Your play could very well be a chronicle of a piece of life right now that can sit alongside Boys in the Band or Angels in America or Tales of the City or anything like that, which is incredible. Okay, so as long as we're talking like into the future, now there it is in Santa Fe. It does really well, gorgeous. It's going to be brilliant at the Fresh Fruit Festival, and everyone's going to love it. Where does it go from there? You're in New York. Well, now where?
Right. It's the kind of thing, because it also has a beauty of its own in terms of the love stories and stuff. It also, I think, even though we have moved forward, I think it has an educational quality to it. And I would love to see it. Like, it's an easy show to put up, much like the Vaginal Monologues was. It's something that a community could do. It doesn't require a big set. You know, it's these stories. I would love to see it go around to college campuses or run. You know, it's that kind of thing where, like, when people are creating their own love and sexuality narratives and identities. You know, I, like I said, we've moved in the era of acceptance, but like, so I teach in the school in Harlem again, and like, we have a class, on gender and sexual orientation. And what I notice is that people love that class because they get to ask about things that they maybe felt they couldn't ask about.
Oh, sure.
About sexuality and gender and stuff like that. And so in a way, this show has a way of maybe giving you an intimate window into something that maybe you're like, yeah, okay, I'm on board with that, but I haven't experienced it, or I haven't, there's questions I have, you know? So I think it has, in a way, an educational quality to it without being preachy, just in a generous kind of inclusive way.
I'm so happy you said about it going to schools. You know, there's the pat answer. Oh, well, we're going to bring it to a contract and we're going to do a, you know, national tour. No, you're giving it to the people who really need to hear it. So I think that's lovely.
I'd like to see that. Yeah, it's a simple piece, or it could run even in a small cabaret type space in New York for forever if it wanted to.
Oh, that's very clever. You know? That's very clever. So I mentioned Tales of the City, and I was binge watching. So after Tales of the City, I watched more Tales of the City and further Tales of the City, and I'm up to the Netflix Tales of the City. I can't even say the name Armistead Maupin anymore without getting dizzy in my head. Do you think there'll be more Lovebirds Jamboree, another Jamboree of Lovebirds Jamboree 3 battling the Avengers? Are we looking at a franchise? Are we looking at you speaking to other people, creating other stories? Even the Vagina Monologues, Eve Ensler created other stories, created more of such things. Are we looking at further stories?
I mean, you know, I've done two story collecting projects. I've been a playwright for 30 years, and I went through a phase of that. So I love doing that kind of work. I mean, I work in the mental health system, and I love listening to people's stories, and you know, I feel like people feel safe with me and share with me in an intimate way that gives strong material. I would certainly be open to it. And if there was a call for it, both of these story collecting projects that I did in the past were called for, were commissioned. Mm-hmm. I guess if I saw that there was a need and a hunger for that, and that I sometimes work in response to what is called forth. And so there's not a plan for that.
It's, you know, I'm writing, you know, sort of more scripts with dialogue and, you know, stories. Mm-hmm. But I would certainly, but I love doing those kinds of projects, and it's certainly in line with who I am as a person, and I would certainly do it if it seemed like it would be of service to the world.
The title has a clever little wink to it. You know, you don't call it Stories of Love or Transcending the Bound. No offense, it doesn't have this lofty title. It has this really fun Lovebird Jamboree.
I know, it's kind of strange.
you essentially picked two sort of cliche or kitschy words for things, which is great. What was the reason it wasn't given a different title? Why did you go for such a wink in terms of the title?
I mean, I think it was partly with David Olson back at Theater Work. I think he partly came up with that title. I think we wanted to create a lightness and a sense of celebration. I think
that's
word jamboree, yep. Is like creates a celebration and a sense of fun. Like this is a party of voices. This is a celebration of people. So like that's the best I can say.
That's what I kind of thought when I first heard the title. I was like, that's clever. And then I thought, of course, it's so welcoming. It's so open. You're going to go in there wanting to cry, wanting to laugh, wanting to applaud because it's a jamboree. You know, it's not a symphony. It's not a moment. It's just this joyous event. And I am sure it's going to be exactly that. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I'm going to make sure our listeners know exactly when, where, and how to see the show, which opens, oh my God, it opens what, like?
Tuesday.
Oh my God. We're up to the hours phase. We're up to the 48 hours phase. I will definitely let our audience know exactly how to come and see it, all about the Fresh Fruit Festival and your marvelous work. And I hope to hear joyous things about your joyous jamboree in the future.
Right. Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
I will talk to you soon. Ciao.
Okay, bye-bye.